Hello, this is Daniel.
And I'm Glennis.
Welcome back to Ill-Informed, a podcast about Illinois government and politics and what you can do to make it better.
Yeah.
Hey, Glennis, what are we talking about this week?
This week, we're talking about the budget. So we're on a podcast talking about how state government works. So naturally, you know we have to talk about the budget. If you live in the state of Illinois, I'm sure you've heard about a budget crisis or programs being affected by state funding in some form. I know I have. But what does all of that mean? I mean, I think, like, that's the big question of it all. Numbers, allocations, formulas, all of it can be very confusing, especially to those of us who are not really directly involved in the budgeting process, which is the purpose of today's episode. Exciting stuff, huh? No, not really.
You know what? We're going to make it exciting.
I think so. I think so. So when I thought about what is the easiest way and the least driest way to approach this topic, I thought about food. I'm a foodie. I'm greedy. So, like, I thought about food. So, like, I want us to imagine that we're baking a cake. Now, personally, I don't really eat cake. The texture doesn't quite do it for me. Why are you blinking hard at me? Like, why did I use that reference?
You went right from... We're going to talk about food because I'm a foodie and I connect with it right to, we're going to talk about cake, which I myself do not eat.
I don't eat, but I felt like it was a really good reference. I just had to connect it because it was the best example that I could use, this type of food. Whatever, Daniel, you'll follow it. Anyway.
You didn't have to talk about my blinking. It's private blinking. It's a podcast, not a TV show.
There's no such thing as private blinking.
Big brother's watching you blink. Anyway, right. I know.
So I don't really like cake, right? Back to that. So the texture doesn't really do it for me, but we're using cake anyway. An alluring, enticing, delicious snack as a metaphor for the budget. Why? Because you'd really be bored out of your mind otherwise. So how does one bake a cake? Daniel's cracking up. How does one bake a cake? Well, for one, we need to know what the ingredients are. Would you agree?
Yes.
Absolutely. Two, we need to know how the ingredients and baking process work together to produce the end product.
Yes.
Yes. And three, we need to have a little taste test, right? To really test, to examine where relevant, what could have or could be done differently along the way to really improve the quality of the texture and taste overall. What do you think of that?
That is exactly what baking a cake feels like to me.
Right. And also what, like, baking a budget feels like.
Right.
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 Bam, I nailed it. So.
This is a good recording session, episode over. I hope this is clarifying for people.
I hope so, too, because right now we're really going to jump into the nuts and bolts. Daniel, what are the ingredients of a state budget? If we're thinking about this cake, and by ingredients, I mean key components. Take us there.
So I'm going to say one really annoying thing just once, I hope.
I hope.
Which
well.
Is that a budget is really like a recipe more than a cake.
Mm.
It's a set of instructions.
Okay.
You know, we think of a budget as like, hey, here's the money. Where does it go?
You're messing with the metaphor, but that's okay. I'm going to follow you.
I'm sorry. I'm an argumentative guy. No, but this is a serious distinction. We think of a budget as like, hey, here's the money. Where does it come from? Where does it go? And in fact, a budget is not the money itself. A budget is just kind of authority, right? Government cannot spend a dime without the authority coming from somewhere. And what a budget is a list of rules that says, hey, you can spend this much money on education. You can spend this much money on mental health. You can spend this much money on this. You can spend this much money on that. It's like a rule book that tells the government what money it's allowed to spend during the course of a year. And so that rule book doesn't create the money. It doesn't have anything to do with the creation of the money, which it comes into the state in the form of taxes. And that tax law doesn't need to change from year to year. In fact, if the state legislature went home for a decade, taxes would still keep on being collected and money would pile up in the state treasury. It's just that there would be no legal authority for any of that money to be spent, and it would keep on being piling up. That's what a budget does. I think it's important to say, before we even say what might go into a budget, that a lot of the instructions to spend money are kind of forced.
What do you mean by forced?
What I mean is when the budget gets written, mm-hmm. there may not be really much of a choice about whether or not to spend certain types of money. Let me give an example to show you what I mean. A pension is a promise that's already been made that someone's going to be receiving money later on. That promise has been made. That promise cannot be broken. Mm-hmm. And so if you put money for pensions in the budget, that's just money to help you keep the promise that's going to get made anyway. And if right. you don't put that money in the budget, it's going to have to be spent another year anyhow.
Okay.
Another example.
Because the commitment was already made.
Exactly. And, okay. the putting it in the budget or not putting it in the budget doesn't alter the commitment.
Gotcha.
Another example is Medicaid, right? So Medicaid is health care for a certain collection of people, for example, people who qualify because they have low enough income. And the way the law is written, irrespective of what goes in the budget, is if you qualify for Medicaid and you go to the doctor and the doctor provides medical services, they're going to get paid by the state. So the budget typically has a bunch of money to pay those doctors to provide services to Medicaid-eligible Illinois residents. Mm-hmm. If that money wasn't in the budget and those doctors wouldn't get paid, they'd still be owed the money from the state. They'd have to get paid eventually. So you can pretend that you're not spending the money by not putting it in the budget, but you're not really changing anything except making people mad at you because they're going to be paid late. Now, so that's like stuff that pretty much has to go in the budget. And if it doesn't go in the budget, the money's still owed eventually.
Right.
There's another category of things that don't really have to go in the budget, but it would be unimaginable to remove them. So a standard example is aid to public schools, mm-hmm. right? Like if the legislature one year decided like we're not funding public schools this year, there would be rioting in the streets across Illinois.
Right.
And so the notion of making really significant cuts to the public school budget is sort of not on the table. And so the punchline is that there's just not that much of the budget that on a practical level is likely to change from year to year. And there's the total budget that's proposed for next year, for example, is $39 billion. It sounds like an enormous amount of money. And of course, it is a lot of money, but it's not like there's going to be someone deciding $1 at a time how to spend $39 billion. Most of that's going to be more or less predetermined before anybody even really starts having the discussions in a serious way.
So how do we get to these nuts and bolts? Thinking about the baking process, because you know we're making that cake. How does a budget get made? Is it done by the governor or the legislature or both?
So let me give the official answer, and then we can talk about the real answer.
Okay.
So the official answer is that the governor gives a budget address and proposes a budget sometime early in the legislative session, you know, in February, basically, or maybe March at the latest. And it's interesting because at that point, a lot of people report that as here's the governor's budget, as if that's now the budget of the state of Illinois. Whereas in practice, that sort of tends to be just sort of a talking point and it gets ignored because then the legislature has to pass a budget, which might sometimes, depending on the relationship between the legislature and the governor, be kind of similar to what the governor proposed. It might be totally different. Mm-hmm. But the legislature has to pass the budget like any other bill. Majority right. of votes in the House, majority of votes in the Senate. Then it goes to the governor, and then either the governor signs it or vetoes it. And if he vetoes it, then it goes back to the legislature, and they can override the veto or not. And then ultimately, the enactment of that law is the budget of Illinois.
Was it always done this way?
Oh, it's almost never done this way.
Tell us the real. How did it really happen?
I mean, I guess the question, and that was an unfairly flip response, but I guess the question that maybe we're really getting at is like, okay, Daniel, you didn't really say very much. So sure, the legislature passes a budget and the governor signs it, but who does what, right? What's the thing that actually gets written? And, you know, it's incredible how much this varies from year to year, right? So a lot of times there'll be a really top-down process where some, you know, a few negotiators, like the governor or his designee, like his budget director, and, you know, the speaker of the House and his designee, like one member of the House and the speaker's budget director, and the president of the Senate and, you know, and his designee, that like a few people like that will just sort of hash it out and negotiate, and then it might get sort of delivered in full form to the legislature at the very end of the session, having been negotiated out by a very small number of people, with the expectation the legislature is going to pass it very quickly.
How is it determined who's going to be hashing it out from year to year?
Well, there's no magic. right? I would say the three people who basically have veto power over the whole thing are the governor, the speaker, and the president.
Yes, yes.
And so ultimately the speaker has to want a bill to pass, and the president of the Senate has to want a bill to pass. And so they have a lot of jurisdiction over what process winds up being created.
Okay.
And it varies from year to year depending on how much control they want to be seen to have, how much control they want to have, how partisan a process it is. Is it an effort to produce a bipartisan budget? And so sometimes, and we'll talk about this in a minute, sometimes they'll not see eye to eye and there'll be massive tension very late in the process. But sometimes they'll sort of have a relatively functional process where essentially the three of them, you know, in a room with maybe they each have another person in the room. So like in a room with six people, just kind of work it out.
One thing that's really, really interesting to me that I'm a little unclear about, hoping that you will unpack this for me. I know that there are these appropriation committees. What is their role in all of this?
Yeah, so this is so strange. Mm-hmm. There's seven committees in the legislature, two in the Senate and five in the House, that are called appropriation committees. So what does appropriate mean? It means put stuff in the budget.
Right.
So there's seven different committees with seven different committee chairs and, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of legislators who serve on these committees. And the committee's nominally supposed to be about writing the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And every single year throughout the legislative session, those committees, if you're just watching from the outside, they act as though they're going to write the budget, right? So they have a hearing every week, and they bring an expert to speak about a particular portion of the budget, and they grill that expert and try to get information and data and push back and forth in debate. And then the next week, they do that about a different chunk of the budget, and they do just what you might imagine a group of people whose job is to write the budget do, except sometimes that winds up with them writing the budget. Sometimes it winds up with them being literally 100% irrelevant, doing nothing whatsoever. Like the whole thing was just like, oh, we'll have fun hearings and ask questions in front of cameras and then just go home as though we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very weird that these committees always exist and always pretend they're relevant when in fact they're sometimes massively relevant. They're sometimes totally irrelevant, and it's pretty hard to predict, you know, in advance of the legislative session whether they're going to be relevant. So you're looking puzzled, but I have no answer. It's just puzzling.
No. I mean, I guess my thought is I always have the, well, what's the point? Why are they there? But so that's the thing that's like screaming and running through my head right now.
So let me give two just sort of examples from my own life. So you know, in I think 2013 and 14, I was in appropriation committees in the Senate, and we like had all these hearings, and it was just pointless. Like there was just no.
Yeah, see, that was running through my head.
And
what was,
you know, it was interesting. Like I would learn stuff, right? If you if you get to be on a committee and you wear your suit and your tie and you like ask some important person questions about what they're doing with all the money they're getting, like that's kind of interesting. But it had nothing to do with actually writing the state's budget. Literally nothing. On the other hand, in 2011 and 2012. When I was in the House, I was on two different appropriation committees, one for elementary and secondary schools and one for higher ed. And what did those committees do? We wrote the damn budget.
Were you appointed to be on those committees? I know we talked about
the
committee appointments in one of the
This is just like
episode.
Any other committee.
Okay.
So like when the session starts, you say, I want to be on this, this, and this, and you might want to be on consumer protection, or you might want to be on healthcare, or you might want to be on an appropriation committee. And so I asked to be on some of these. So when I was in the House, we wrote the budget. Like we met in, you know, we had all these public hearings and so on and so forth, and then we met in private, Democrats and Republicans, interestingly, in a room with butcher paper that was put over the glass door so no one could see in, and there was a spreadsheet that was projected onto the wall, and we were like as a group arguing about how to tweak numbers in that spreadsheet.
What's the difference, though? You know, how could in 1 year it be very relevant and you actually are doing the work of the committee, and then in another year, not so much? Like, what's
because there's a decision that's made above that pay grade about the process by which the real budget's going to get written.
Gotcha.
And
that
wasn't our call. We would have always probably wanted to write the budget because why the hell else would you be on the committee?
Right.
But that was not our call. Sometimes we were told like, oh, y'all are very nice, and we get patted on the head and given a cookie for our trouble, and then someone else would write the budget and ask us to vote for it.
Gotcha.
And some years we'd actually write the budget.
Write the budget, okay.
And so then the question you might ask is, what's better?
What do you think is better?
Well, so... Like, obviously, it's a lot more attractive if the legislators who are the elected representatives of the people and are supposed to be subject matter experts, because why else would they have asked to be on this committee,
right,
than, like, hash the thing out, right?
And
like,
and have a voice.
We legit had the discussions, right? We would sit there and yell at each other about, oh, no, we got to move 100,000 from this line to that line. So that all sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't help but admit that the conversations themselves that we had, though they were real people hashing out real things, they were not very strategic. And so we'd wind up, like, bickering about little things. And I remember there's one moment that really sticks in my mind. This was supposed to be a House members-only private secret meeting, but we let, at one point, a single senator who was really involved in budget negotiations in the room for a discussion about the education budget,
mm-hmm,
just to watch. And so we're, like, arguing back and forth in this private meeting about the education budget. And there's just a senator in the corner, and I'm noticing he's, like, starting to fidget and he's getting jittery. And then he stands up and he starts pacing back and forth like he's really antsy. And mm-hmm, finally he just goes toward the door, and I pulled him aside and I was like, why are you leaving? What's the problem? And he said, the amount of time that you guys spend talking about a given line item in this budget,
mm-hmm,
is inversely proportional to the size of the line. We would, like, sign off on $4 billion without a second thought and then, like, really get into it over where to put $250,000. And that type of phenomenon...
It's like... That's the thing that probably should have happened on the front end.
Well, if you had a... And I hate to sound... I mean, this is going to sound like I'm some sort of nightmare consultant. But if you had a process,
mm-hmm,
to kind of... organize your decisions by hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the biggest, highest level, most important decision, and how are we going to hash that out? And then what decisions does that leave once we've hashed it out? Then you might have a useful process. But we had nothing at all. We just had, like, a bunch of people in a room,
mm-hmm,
who'd been handed this type of power they'd never seen before, and then it just, like, kind of turned into, you know, an unruly sandbox in a preschool really, really quickly.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yikes.
Wow.
Another example that I think of was in that same discussion, in that same room about that same education budget, there was a reason why we didn't think about the biggest number, because that was just like a giant lump of money that got distributed by some incredibly complicated formula to school districts across the state. And there was kind of almost an implicit agreement not to haggle about that formula. But that formula was not working. And there were some technical things that are not worth getting into now that were really unfair about how that formula was operating in that year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made the tragic strategic mistake of trying to bring that up. And so here we were in a room of legislators supposed to figure out how to fund schools in Illinois. And I was like, hey, here's a pretty minor change that would make this formula work more fairly. It would be more rational. If you were to just ask a person on the street, does this new idea make more sense than the old idea? Most people would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I proposed it, instantly, of course, this in retrospect made perfect sense, instantly everybody in the room, instead of asking, like, hey, does the philosophy that Daniel's articulating make sense, they just said, well, hold on, what would the impact be on the school districts that I happen to represent personally?
Right.
And then, you know, the fact that the committee just by coincidence happened to have more people whose school districts were harmed by this change than were helped meant that the idea couldn't go anywhere. Right, so it's not as though it was a mechanism to have a holistic discussion about what the state needs. It was kind of a sort of a free-for-all between people with pretty different and sometimes relatively parochial interests.
Yeah. One thing that's an interest of mine, and I'm not particularly an expert in it, but much of my work is around the healing and liberation of Black and brown communities. And part of that healing really includes mental health and wellness. The Illinois Coalition for Better Mental Health Care recently reported that there are over 2.5 million people in the state of Illinois living with a mental health condition. And I'd imagine that there's even more of cases that are undocumented and not reported, especially when you take into consideration equity-related factors such as people who are undiagnosed because of the lack of access to treatment or care. However, there hasn't been a ton of state-level investment in this particular area. Why isn't there more investment in areas such as mental health? And that's just one of many. And that's one part of the question, not to make it double-barreled, but, like, what can we do to push these kinds of issues as a budget priority?
Yeah, Illinois has a really, really bad record at funding not only mental health in particular, but human services more broadly, right? So, for example, I know a lot of families who have felt that they need to move to a neighboring state because of specifically the education opportunities for kids with developmental disabilities. Yeah. Right? It's another area that we just do a rotten job in Illinois. The thing about it is, if you were to ask a typical person running for office or a typical person voting for a candidate for state legislature, do you think we ought to cut mental health spending? Almost all of them, including most Republicans, including most fiscally conservative people, would say, no, we don't need to cut mental health spending. We need to make sure we provide these services. So how could it be that that's what most people say when you ask them, and yet, here we are? And I think it's a really blunt political calculation. So you've got this budget. You have budget challenges, and we'll talk more about those in a minute. Yeah. And then you're confronted with the question about, what do we do in a tough budget year? Like, something's not adding up. What do we do to make it add up?
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, there's a lot of conversations to be had about bringing in more revenue.
Okay.
We'll talk about that later. But let's assume it's a year when that's not happening. And then something's got to give. And I think you very, very frequently find situations where legislators are like, you know, a lot of people are going to be upset if we cut funding for mental health, but a lot more people are going to be calling for my head if we cut funding for every single neighborhood school.
Got you.
And
yeah.
And I think that's the calculation, which is, you know, again, you can view that as a cynical calculation. You can view that as a sort of, that's how the system's supposed to respond to the preferences of the electorate. But the consequences of it kind of accumulated over the course of decades now have been really, really consistent and severe.
Mm.
And one thing that I don't have a great answer to, but that I think is a really, really important question is, why has it gone so far in this direction in Illinois?
Yeah.
Why isn't there some kind of backstop that keeps a basic level of services that other states, including many neighboring states, have managed to have? And I think that speaks somehow to the callousness of the political calculations that exist inside Illinois, which I think are, because of the kind of history of machine politics, are a little bit more severe and a little bit more inhuman, frankly, than what you might see in other states.
That's a perfect segue to the taste test. Coming back to this cake, which is, you know, that was not such a light reference that you gave, but I do think it is connected because we always talk about how the Illinois budget is a mess. What does that mean? What do the Illinois budget problems actually look like?
Yeah, I mean, particularly when I was a state legislator, I couldn't go anywhere and say I was a state legislator in Illinois. And by anywhere, I don't mean just in the state. I mean anywhere in the country. I couldn't go anywhere and say I'm an Illinois state senator and not have people be like, whoa, your budget, your pensions. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, without necessarily having a lot of detail, I think there's a widespread sense that we have a really, really big budget problem in Illinois. And so, you know, do
yeah.
we?
Right? Yeah.
And the answer, unfortunately, is yes. I, you know, there's a lot of ways in which I don't agree with or feel that the rhetoric that you hear around this is constructive. But the basic kind of black and white question, do we have giant budget problems that are unlike almost all other states? Mm-hmm. The answer to that is yes. And, you know, it's complicated, unfortunately. You know, I think a lot of people sort of assume if we have a big budget problem must mean we've borrowed a lot of money. Like we've gone to the bond markets and issued bonds and borrowed money. And now there's like somebody sitting out there somewhere in New York who we owe a lot of money to. And that's what it means to have a bad budget situation. And that is, in fact, not the case. The amount of money like that we owe in the super traditional you borrowed it and now you've got to pay it back sense is not out of line with other states.
So what are the fundamental budget problems in the state of Illinois that makes us unique and different from other states?
So there's a few. I mean, certainly I will say the famous one, pensions, is true. So what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Pension is a commitment to pay someone after their retirement for the rest of their life, a certain amount of money. And having made that commitment, we can estimate what it costs. How much money should we have put aside to be able to meet those commitments? And the gap between what we should have put aside and what we have put aside is really unlike almost any other state. And so it's now, well over $100 billion missing. And that's just a severe, severe problem that is worse than almost any other state. And it's because of years and years and years and years and years of not putting into the pension systems what the promises we were making at the time called for. And sort of again and again saying, I could put this money in the pension system, but if I didn't, then I would have more to spend on something else, or I could make taxes lower, and so I'll do that instead, and then let it be somebody else's problem. And then somebody else's problem kept on getting worse and worse because they kept on doing that. So that's number one. The second way in which we might sometimes look different is just literal bill backlog, mm-hmm. right? So we may not go to the markets and borrow money, but we may just pay vendors super late.
Gotcha.
And during the time that there was a budget impasse, that bill backlog ran up well north of $10 billion.
Right.
So, if you talk to folks who are running, especially small community human service providers, they would be like, we're supposed to be getting enough money from the state, and if we got it, we could keep our doors open, but they're a year behind, and we don't have the size to handle that kind of delayed payment. So that's debt. It's just you don't owe money to a bank. You owe money to a mental health provider.
Okay.
And then I want to give one more category, which is more sort of, it might feel a little softer, but it's super important. Mm-hmm. And that is that the public sector in the state of Illinois has failed to invest in itself. And so we've done things like deferred maintenance on buildings and the physical plant at our universities. We've done things like not invested in the CTA here in Chicago.
Right.
So when you don't spend in the kind of maintenance that's needed for your systems to continue to be functional, that's not like on a balance sheet necessarily anywhere, but that's effectively running a debt. Because at some point, you're going to have to catch up and make those investments.
Exactly. That's real.
So that's another way in which our finances are more screwed up than many states. So those are the ways in which the Illinois budget is genuinely, worse than most states' budgets in ways that we feel.
Can you hear that? That's my taste test. That don't taste good. So if we're going back to this fiscal year, why wasn't there enough money to essentially pay the bills?
Yeah, I mean, basically over the years, it's always been easier for the people in power to find ways to not fully pay for what they were promising. Mm-hmm. The alternative, if you don't want to do that, if you don't want to create the situation we're in, you either need to raise taxes to bring in more money,
right,
or you need to make fewer promises. And it's politically difficult to do either one of those things. And unfortunately, we set up a budget system in Illinois where it was really easy to, like, for example, just not pay the pension system. Promise people you're going to guarantee them a pension after they retire, but just not put money in and hope that that problem goes away later after you're retired. It's been very easy for us to just have a giant bill backlog where there's like $12 billion of invoices on the desk of the state controller, but no cash to actually make those payments. And if there's no negative consequence to the people in power for allowing that to persist, they're going to do it because the political ramifications of actually raising everyone's taxes to find the money are no fun for politicians to bear.
What might some of those political ramifications look like?
You've spoken very eloquently about the injustice of asking a mental health provider who is themselves paying taxes to somehow survive a 10-month delay in their payments. But the truth is that when that happened, you then didn't have people demonstrating in the streets saying, fire all the politicians because the mental health providers are being paid 10 months late. It didn't happen. During all the years that the pension systems were being shorted and the money wasn't being put in there, there was no one saying, you can't do this to us and we're going to vote you out unless you make that pension system whole. And so there was this feeling that you could get away with it. And unfortunately, a lot of them did get away with it for generations.
Yeah. About the structural issues, the major structural issues that we have in the state of Illinois, what are some things that could be done to improve the structure that would not come at a greater expense to the people that are already being impacted by it?
Right. So if you want to actually solve this budget problem, you're going to have to fundamentally do real cuts or else bring in real revenue, right? And so I think, you know, based on what we've talked about, what money is going where, it becomes pretty clear that there aren't significant ways to make major cuts without either just, you know, kicking the can further down the road and obligating yourself to pay even more next year, or else cutting things where you're really, really harming people. And I know there's kind of a rejoinder to that where people will say, you know, yeah, but can't you run government more efficiently? I'm not asking you to shut down mental health facilities. I'm asking you to do the whole thing in a more efficient way and squeeze out some unnecessary cost. And the answer to that is, you know, sure. And we should always try to do everything more efficiently. But the notion that you can actually find the kind of money that we're talking about here by, like, you know, being a little bit more aggressive and bidding down the cost of the staples that the Department of Human Services uses is craziness.
Yeah.
And so that's, to me, that's a red herring. It's not a bad thing to try to do, but it's a red herring as a budget solution. And so that leaves the question of how you're going to bring in more revenue.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a bit and kind of focus a bit on some of the revenue solutions that Governor Pritzker is pushing. One of them is really changing Illinois to a graduated income tax, and it's a pretty big fight. So I think one thing that's helpful is to start with a bit of an overview really quickly of just like the difference between progressive taxation, and progressive and graduated is they can be used interchangeably, synonymous, correct?
Correct. And now we're supposed to call it a fair tax.
Fair tax.
That's the official branding.
The official branding is a fair tax.
Next year it'll be the amazing tax.
The amazing tax. But it's all we're for. So graduated, progressive, or fair tax is essentially a tiered tax system, and which as opposed to a flat taxation is everybody essentially has the same tax rate in terms of the percentage of their income, regardless of, you know, what it is that they're making. So no one pays more or less. And in a progressive, graduated, fair tax system, people who make more money will pay higher taxes, and people who make less money will pay less taxes. Would you say that that's a pretty good overview of that?
Yeah, the current system, everyone pays the same percentage.
Right.
So if you make and that percentage is 4.95. So if you make $100, you pay $4.95.
Yep.
If you make $100 million, you pay $4,950,000. Mm-hmm. Whatever number it is, it's the same percentage you're paying.
Exactly. Yeah.
And a fair tax would say, we'll ask someone who's making $100 million
should pay a little more,
pay a higher percentage.
Exactly, because they can afford it.
That's the theory.
That is theory. Let's talk about how fair tax and this proposal for a tiered system of taxation compares to other states.
Yeah, I think this is really key here. So, you know, in most places, if you make more, you pay a higher percentage.
Right.
That's just how it is. Not just in, you know, traditionally liberal or blue states. It's how it is in Alabama. It's how it is in North Dakota.
Yeah.
It's certainly how it is in Wisconsin and Iowa and Missouri. It's how it is in the federal government, too. And by the way, even Republicans and Democrats support keeping it that way, typically, on the federal level. But in Illinois, it's not. Illinois is one of a tiny number of states where not only does everybody pay the same tax rate, the same percentage, no matter how much they earn, but the constitution of the state mandates that. And just as a quick history point, that got written into the Constitution in 1970. And 1970, if you think about it, it was kind of the high water mark for economic equality in America. The economy was more equal then. There was less of a wealth divide than any other time in the last 200 years in America.
Yeah.
And so at that moment when they did this, the feeling was inequality is not that big a problem. That's kind of the attitude that folks had. So they said, well, if inequality is not that big a problem, then let's let everybody pay the same tax rate. That's what seemed fair at the time. And we don't have to argue about whether or not that was fair at the time. But what I would say unquestionably is whether or not it was the right decision for the time, they shouldn't have locked it in the Constitution.
Right.
Because since 1970, there's been a huge spike in inequality. Now, the divide is growing. The rich are getting richer. The middle class is shrinking.
Yeah.
The poor are struggling more and more.
Things are becoming much more inequitable. Absolutely.
And many, 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 many states are responding to that spike in inequality by saying, let's ask people with more to pay a higher rate. But in Illinois, we can't do that because of what they put in the Constitution 50 years ago. And what I would say is, let's have that debate about whether or not we should use the tax code
right.
to address that problem. Let's not have the Constitution tell us we don't even get to talk about it.
Right, right, right.
So that's what this fight is. This is a fight that's been led by Governor Pritzker, a fight that I, you know, personally speaking, believe very strongly is the right and important thing for the state. And the fight here is to change the Constitution so it would then be allowed to ask the wealthy to pay a higher tax rate. And then you could use that tool of asking rich folks to pay a higher rate to bring in more money and start to fix the state's budget problems.
Absolutely.
And by the way, both because of his personal wealth and because of the extraordinary personal wealth of most people who oppose this, because
yeah.
right, think about who doesn't want the wealthy to pay a higher tax rate.
Right.
Because of all of that money on both sides, there's a tremendous amount of money that's going to be spent in this campaign as well, which I think is going to be really shaping the debate in Illinois for the next year and a half.
I think we've baked a cake. I don't know how it looks. It ended tasting a little better than what it started, even though I don't eat cake. How does it taste to you?
I mean, I'm actually more concerned about whether it's literally poisoned at this point.
Oh, Lord. Oh, gosh. It might just be. I used to love cake, for the record. I mean, just kidding. That's a lie. I never loved cake.
That's an incredibly weird lie. It's really,
okay.
I'm trying to understand what would lead you to just make that up.
Exactly. I didn't. Okay. So just, I'll explain it. And we're taking up airtime. So I'm really going to be brief.
Glennon's, the people need to know.
I have a picture of me when I was one with my my hands over my head. Do you want to describe the visual?
Glennon's hands are over her head.
We do this for the people with my hands over my head and I'm screaming at this cake. And from age one, I just didn't like the cake. I don't know if the cake was yelling at me or talking at me or be like, eat me right now. I don't know. But it just didn't work out. But then my grandmother used to make, was from the South, and she used to make this pineapple upside down cake that was drenched in pineapple. And it was so juicy and so delicious that I loved it. And when my grandmother passed away, I just never, that was the only cake I would eat. On my birthday every year, she would make me a pineapple upside down cake. And that's the only cake I ever ate and could eat. And so when I said that, I was actually thinking about my late grandmother whose cake I did eat every year.
Well, I also had a 1-year-old episode. My first birthday, my mother made a cake that almost killed me.
Oh my gosh.
Because of an allergic reaction.
What? Are you allergic to cake?
Not anymore. I got over it. I got with the cake program.
How'd you get over it? You just kept eating more cake?
I don't think the allergy was cake specifically.
Okay. What? So I just kept feeding you
more? I believe
more?
The ingredient to which I ceased to be allergic not long thereafter was walnut.
Well, I think that that's a perfect segue. I'm sorry about your walnut allergy, and I hope that you're no longer eating walnut. But I think
I am. I ended the allergy. I recognized that cake was more important than my own physical health.
Oh, yikes. Oh, my gosh.
Made a commitment to retrain my autoimmune system.
I did that with pistachios. But speaking of nuts, I think that we've finished with these nuts and bolts for today. That's where that was going.
It was worth it. Chaos is worth everything.
Join us Monday, April 29th for a live show where you can get a bird's eye view on the awkwardness of Daniel and I in the studio.
When you sell it like that.
It's beautiful. It absolutely is. We will be at Lagunitas for a live show. If you are looking for tickets, you can follow us on social media at State Matters or go to the website www.statematters.org.
And if you are concerned about the awkwardness of Glennis and Daniel, the good news is there will be two guests with us, State Senator Ram Vilavalam and Kadeen Bennett, a lobbyist for the ACLU. They're not awkward at all. It'll be great.
Yeah, so you can just not pay attention to us at all, although that might be pretty challenging because we're pretty awesome.
Hard to ignore.
Yeah, I agree.